91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we discuss toxic chemical poisoning from an angle not readily thought of, the exposure to mysterious elements within high-rise buildings. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman. It's the story of high-profile South Florida prosecuting attorney Alan Bell and his enigmatic brush with unknown chemical exposure. Because of his protracted maladies, Alan Bell found that millions of people fall ill because of toxicity exposures without knowing they're at risk. Bell has written Poisoned: How a Crime-Busting Prosecutor Turned His Medical Mystery into a Crusade for Environmental Victims. This reaction to unknown chemicals in building is now referred to as the silent epidemic. Join us for an interview after NPR and regional news. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, it's today's Topical Currents. This hour we speak about buildings that can potentially harbor toxic chemicals and molds with attorney, author, and author Alan Bell.
He grew up in South Florida, a Coral Park High grad, and attended the University of Miami. He was a big-time prosecutor in the Miami Vice era in the 1980s, then moved on to other courtrooms.
He lived and worked in the same high-rise building in Fort Lauderdale. And that's where the story covered in his book begins.
It's called Poisoned: How a Crime-Busting Prosecutor Turned His Medical Mystery into a Crusade for Environmental Victims.
And he joins us now from Irvine, California. Welcome to you, Alan Bell.
Let's start at the beginning with a profile of you before you became ill. Your life, you were a healthy, athletic person. You had an idyllic life. You were a big attorney, prosecuting attorney. Tell us about that time.
Well, take yourself back to the 1980s. I was living in Miami, and I was an organized crime prosecutor. Those were the days of the cocaine cowboys. I was prosecuting Colombian cartel drug rings and the mafia. When they were filming Miami Vice, I was actually living it, hanging out of helicopters, wearing a .357 shoulder holster, and living the American dream. That's what I was doing back then.
Now, you also had political aspirations, isn't that correct?
I was on track to run for a United States senatorial seat. Yes, I was.
And so what happened to that life? Now, you had a wife and a young baby, correct?
Yeah, I was living the American dream. I had a young baby girl going on international ski vacations, new house, just basically a great marriage, living the idyllic life. And then suddenly, something strange happened. I began coming down with a bizarre set of medical symptoms. It started off as a sore throat, teary eyes. My lungs started burning. It turned into what you would call flu-like symptoms. And I began going from doctor to doctor. Pretty soon, the symptoms progressed to become so extreme that I was developing grand mal seizures. I went to every medical center across the country: Mayo Clinic, Cleveland Clinic, National Jewish, University of Miami, University of Colorado, and the list goes on and on and on.
Over what time period are we talking about? How long did this happen? You're getting sick, the progression of your illness, and going to all these doctors?
The progression of the illness, I'd say from the beginning till the time when I started going from doctor to doctor, was over a period of maybe 3 or 4 months. Mm-hmm. And I would say within 4 or 5 months, I was going all over the country looking for help. I ended up at a hospital called National Jewish Hospital in Denver, Colorado. And I vividly remember the doctor sitting down with me with a very grim face and looking at me and saying, "Mr. Bell, the latest rounds of blood tests came back, and it indicates that you were poisoned." And I jolted back in my chair and looked at him and said, "What do you mean I was poisoned? These blood tests are indicative of someone who was poisoned." And then the next thing he asked me was, "Mr. Bell, do you know of anybody that would have wanted to poison you?" And I just sort of sat back in my chair and chuckled and said, "Yeah, they could take a ticket and wait online. There's numerous mafiosos and Colombian cartel drug people that would have loved to knock me off.
Right.
And so the way we left it was, he says, go back to Miami, rest for a little while. We'll prepare for another round of tests. And that's how he left it. So I flew back to Miami.
Didn't he, though, excuse me, want to give you any medicine or something?
At that point,
yeah.
No.
Oh, okay.
At that point, no, because they weren't really sure what they were dealing with. It was an indirect indication of a poison, but they didn't know what kind of poison. They just knew it was adversely affecting the nervous system, the brain, and the immune system. Mm. And it had the classic fingerprint of a poisoning. So that's how, it's not like, okay, we know what this poison is, we're going to give you an antidote and you're going to be all better. It wasn't like that at all. So I went back to South Florida. I was an organized crime prosecutor in Fort Lauderdale at the time. And I sat down with my investigators and I asked them, we need to find out who poisoned me. So they went through every aspect of my life. They investigated the movie theaters that I went to, the restaurants that I ate at, the gymnasiums that I worked out in, the friends that I associated with, the courthouse that I worked in, and then ultimately the building that I worked in. And what they discovered was is that there were dozens of other people in that building that were getting ill as well. And my first thought was, oh, my God, you mean they're poisoning other people in the building mm-hmm. as well? That was my first thought. But as this was happening, I went to another specialist in Boca Raton who specialized in environmental medicine. And he looked at all my records and came to the conclusion that the building that I was working in poisoned me. It's called sick building syndrome. And he basically told me that I was poisoned by the building and it damaged my brain and my nervous system and my immune system. That was the good news. The bad news is that he told me that it had caused me to become hypersensitive to everything in the environment. Perfumes, colognes, hairsprays, automobile exhaust, you name it. And the only remedy that he could prescribe was to send me into a bubble in the middle of the Arizona desert where there was no pollens, no molds, and no chemicals. Or if I didn't do that, the prognosis was I was going to die.
Of course, when you were here in South Florida, the climate here is so prone to mildew and such. But there was a portion of your book where you described that you had, where your lungs felt like they were on fire, and they did an emergency endoscopy and found that your lungs were, the exterior of your lungs were just covered in bacteria. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, what they discovered is that the tissues inside the lungs were covered with mold, and the mold had infiltrated into my lungs, which was causing it felt like I was burning alive every time I took a breath. That's how severe it was. So what happened is the mold that we were breathing, or the things that were in the building, had gotten into my lungs, and it started growing inside my lungs.
Alan, when you say there were other people in the building that were sick, many other people that your investigators found, were they as sick as you were, or were you for some reason more susceptible to a more severe form of the illness?
That's a good question. And the answer is that the reactions from various other people varied from minor to major. There was actually a judge's daughter that died from being inside that building.
They traced her death to the toxins in the building?
Well, put it this way. She left the building when I did. She knew the building was making her sick. I had a discussion with her about this personally, and she told me that this building had made her sick. She was getting out before it was too late. She was a young, healthy, athletic woman, and shortly thereafter, she died. Just put the pieces together. But in answer to your other question, different people react to different things. And depending on each individual's biochemical fingerprint, each person is going to react differently. If you get 100 people and you put them in a room and you gas them with toxic chemicals, there's going to be a subpopulation of several of those people, they're going to come down with a various types of different chronic disease. You may get lung cancer. The next person may get prostate cancer. The next person may get asthma. The next person may get what I've got. And it all depends on the interaction between the genes that you're born with and the environment that you're exposed to. And the best way I could illustrate this is, let's say you've got a husband and wife that's been married for 30 years. The husband smokes 3 packs of cigarettes a day. He's fine. He doesn't get lung cancer. But his wife, breathing the secondhand smoke, ends up getting lung cancer. That's a perfect illustration of what I'm trying to explain.
Now, the building in question was in Fort Lauderdale, the Tower 110. And oddly enough, it was brand new when you moved in. So one would, on first thought, think, well, this building certainly doesn't have a mildew and mold problem.
That's right. In that particular case, it was a brand new building. They had new carpeting, new glues, new paints, new plastics. And they were not bringing in outside air to dilute those volatile organic compounds. So we were breathing in this stale air to save electricity costs. And along with that, when you close up a system like that, it could create mold as well. So that's what happened back in the 80s. Since then, we've learned that we cannot seal up our buildings and we need to bring in a certain percentage of fresh air or this sick building syndrome is going to manifest. Now, let me give you an idea on how pervasive this sick building syndrome is. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, 75 million Americans become ill each year because of the buildings that we work in. Can you imagine that?
That's a lot of people, you know, and it's not as though people can just leave their jobs. Most people need their jobs in order to survive.
That's right. And that statistic only covers the buildings that they work in.
Right.
It does not include the homes that we work in, the communities that we live in. It's a pervasive issue. You see, this whole environmental movement we once thought was about the whales and the birds and the trees. But we now know that the bottom line is about saving the humans. And in the past, any person that spoke about promoting health, they would focus on diet and exercise. But we're living in a whole new world now. The paradigm has shifted. It's now also about what you breathe and what you touch, which is so important in terms of your health and your longevity.
Oddly enough, if you go on the Tower 110 website, you see that they're now a LEED designated building and also really tout their environmental innovations.
Right.
They did.
They rectified the situation.
They rectified things. And you went back to the building yourself.
Right.
Interesting. Yes, I did. That was one of the dragons that I needed to slay. And years later, when I became well enough to return to South Florida, I did go into that building. And wouldn't you know it, it was perfectly safe.
You know, you mentioned, and we're going to go back to the bubble because that's a pretty fascinating thing that you did for 8 years. But when you talk about what we eat, drink, breathe, and touch, now we obviously have a little bit more control over what we eat and drink and touch than we do over what we breathe. So I guess we'll, in short, or you know, as we go on in the show, we'll get to some of the remedies that you suggest for those, because that's obviously not something we have that much control over.
Well, ironically enough, according to the Environmental Protection Agency, Americans spend over 90% of our time indoors. Okay? So if you're spending 90% of your time indoors, that's something that you can control, particularly your own home, which we can get into later. And the other 10%, well, in my book, we have a reference to outdoor air pollution in any part of the country and where you're living. And you could plug into that site and see what the quality of the air is outside in your community. And you make your own decision as to whether or not you want to stay there. If you have the luxury to move and it's really bad outdoor air quality, get out. If you don't have the luxury to move, then the next best thing to do is control what you can control, which is 90% of your time indoors.
Let me ask you something. You know, we may have listeners right now that have sick building syndrome, but my question is, the symptoms mimic so many other illnesses. They're so broad, you know, depression, irritability, inability to concentrate, memory loss, digestive problems. How does one know? Is there a test that doctors administer to determine this?
The short answer is no, there is no test. And let me expand upon that a little bit. First of all, the average medical student only gets 6 hours of instruction in medical school on how the environment is interfaced with human health. Yet, more people get sick and die from environmental exposure than all those afflicted with AIDS, automobile accidents, war, and crime combined. It is the silent epidemic of the 21st century, yet our doctors are not equipped to even recognize it. But let me tell you this for the audience in South Florida. Did you know that the state of Florida, according to the Huffington Post, is the third most toxic state in America? That's huge. And that gets into the hot, humid climate where we have to spray pesticides everywhere to control the bugs. And these pesticides are neurotoxins. They're cousins to nerve gas, to sarin, that they sprayed in Syria. And we're spraying this in our homes, our schools, our workplaces, our communities, and even in the air to control the Zika virus.
Right.
So South Florida, I've always said, is ground zero for toxicity in this country.
Where did you say it rates, according to the Huffington Post? The
third most toxic state in America.
What are the other two above it?
I don't know. I don't have that.
Okay,
they may well be Rust Belt states or something.
Yeah,
too.
It could be. Well,
I know Ohio's up there, but, in preparation for this show, I just really, focused on Florida. I'm a Florida boy. I grew up in Miami. I went to high school in Miami. I went to college at the University of Miami, law school at the University of Miami. I interned under Janet Reno in the state attorney's office in Dade County. That was my life. That's my home, South Florida. So it's near and dear to my heart, and it's an impact that I would love to make a difference in.
Well, okay, so let's go back to the bubble. So you're told that you cannot be exposed to anything. So where you went to Arizona, tell us about what happened.
So they airlifted me on oxygen in a special air ambulance into a bubble, which was 800 square feet, made out of glass, brick, and steel. And inside this bubble, there was nothing, no carpeting, no drapes, no soft beds, no soft couches, no fabrics. It was like a cold, austere jail cell. And outside the bubble, 50 miles in all directions, you saw nothing. No cars, no roads, no schools, no street lights, no people, no houses, just cactus. And I ended up in this bubble. I went down to 145 pounds, and I'm 6'2", by the way, in a wheelchair, tethered to an oxygen tank. Mm. And by that time, I was in isolation in this bubble. And it was just my daughter and I. My wife had left. She could not handle the situation and left me and our daughter. And I look over to my daughter and her big blue eyes and her red hair, and I thought to myself, I've got to fight back, because if I don't, my little girl, Ashley, is going to become an orphan. So I looked around the room inside this bubble from my wheelchair, and I saw four tools that I had to work with: phone, fax, pencil, and paper. And with that telephone, I began reaching the top scientists on the planet. And I had an aha moment where I discovered, by talking to the scientists, that my plight was just a tip of this iceberg, and that millions of people are getting sick and dying from all sorts of environmentally linked diseases in their own homes, in their own schools, in their own workplaces. So I started a little charity called the Environmental Health Foundation from inside this bubble. And we got top scientists from Harvard and Yale and Johns Hopkins and University of Arizona and University of Miami and the Environmental Protection Agency and the National Institutes of Health, and the list goes on and on and on. And we raised money, and we got celebrities involved. Al Gore was the vice president at the time. He supported it. Gene Cernan, the commander of Apollo 17, the last man to walk on the moon, supported it. Alan Thicke, Jason Priestley, Matthew Perry, Kenny Loggins from Loggins & Messina, they all jumped on board. We raised money, and we donated it to research. And there came a point in time where we were going to have this big summit in the middle of the Arizona desert in the Biosphere 2, which is where what it was called. And all these scientists convened from all over the United States to show up at this summit that the charity that I started created. I created this summit. I was too ill to attend the summit myself, but my daughter, Ashley, attended on my behalf. And little did I know, when she was walking among these prestigious scientists wearing their white lab coats, she went up to them one by one, this little girl, and asked them, "Excuse me, sir, I know that you're helping millions of people by doing this research, but why can't you help my daddy?" And I didn't know that she was doing this at the time. And one of the scientists gave her a name and phone number of a doctor who, he said, "Listen, honey, I think this doctor will help your dad." And sure enough, he did. This was a doctor based out of Dallas that had treated multiple Gulf War veterans who were injured by the toxins they were exposed to in the Gulf War. And he gave me the same treatment that got me back out of the bubble.
Now, how long?
8 years.
8 years. So during those 8 years, no other doctor, I mean, you had no, with all the, doctors and scientists you were contacting, nobody had any advice for you or medical or any other treatment than just staying in that enclosed bubble?
I had seen over 100 doctors, spent over $1 million in medical bills, went all over the United States, and I discovered a doctor based in Dallas. It's called the Environmental Health Center in Dallas. And I went there. This is before I ended up in the bubble. And I met people from all over the world that went to this doctor's office, all over the world, and they were injured like I was, the same way, and they ended up the same way. And this was the world specialist in Dallas, and all he could do was offer, you know, vitamins, IVs, and isolation. There was no cure. And by the time I had found that out, I realized that I had exhausted all remedies and basically resorted back into isolation.
You must have been also pretty exhausted financially, plus this staying in this bubble couldn't have been a cheap proposition. How did you swing that?
Well, I was fortunate that my family was very supportive of me, and they helped me every step of the way. In fact, my family also supported the foundation that I started. Actually, the Environmental Health Foundation ended up in newspapers and magazines all over the country, including the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel.
We're gonna take a short break, Alan. I wanted to ask you, is the Environmental Health Foundation still operative?
It's not active right now because what I did is I jumped back into the legal arena, and I'll talk to you about that next.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. Alan Bell is a former organized crime prosecutor and toxic tort lawyer as well. In his words, he now is a victim, survivor, advocate, and avenger, and an author of Poisoned. We'll be right back.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. We resume our conversation with attorney and author Alan Bell. He's joining us from Irvine, California. And before we took our break, we were talking about the bubble, Alan, and the difficulties of being in it. And when did you finally emerge?
I finally emerged 8 years later. This doctor led me to a new anti-seizure medicine that basically got me out of the bubble. And reemerging was a slow process because it's hard to imagine being cut off from the world for 8 years, cut off from everything. I couldn't even go near a television set because of the electromagnetic frequencies caused me to have seizures. So my only contact to the outside world was basically radio and reading. I couldn't even read newsprint unless I put glass over it because the print would cause me to have seizures. So basically cut off for that period of time, reemerging into the world was quite an ordeal. It's almost like Rip Van Winkle waking up from a 8-year coma and seeing how much the world had changed. You know, the styles and cars changed, the clothing changed, the news changed, stores changed. Just imagine, 8 years.
I imagine you listen to a lot of NPR.
I did, actually. But it was hard to listen to because I was in the middle of nowhere. I mean,
well, you didn't get a good signal.
I was
right.
Didn't get a good signal.
I can't imagine what your immune system must have been like coming out of that thing. And, you know, you talk about not being able to watch TV or touch newsprint or anything, but just going into the world, which is filled with germs and bacteria and all sorts of things. How long did that take you to be able to function in the world?
Well, here's the thing, Bonnie. The issue was not germs. It wasn't biological sensitivities that I had. It was man-made chemicals. So if you had a cold or a flu, I would have no greater of a chance of getting that than you would. Uh-huh. However, if you expose me to chemicals, you know, such as formaldehyde and isocyanates and paints, and that's the kind of stuff that was deadly to me.
Now the drug
but
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead. But it was a.
You go ahead, please.
Sorry. Go ahead.
I'll do this.
Okay, Joseph. So it was a slow process where I, ventured out a little bit and then went back in and a little more and went back in until slowly. I mean, I could remember going to a mall for the first time. It was like, oh my God, look at all the styles that have changed. I could remember my daughter taking me to a movie theater for the first time and listening to the surround sound. I was startled. There was no surround sound when I went into the bubble. So all of these new inventions took some time to get accustomed to. If anybody has saw the movie The Martian with Matt Damon, when he was isolated on Mars and he had to be resourceful to survive in isolation, that's the best analogy that I can make to you.
Just as a practical matter, how did your daughter, did she go to school? Did she go out of the bubble and live her life? Yeah.
She did.
Oh, okay.
I had her schooled. I had a nanny that would pick her up and take her places and take her to buy clothes and the aide would go and buy food and bring it back for us and cook it. I couldn't even go near cooking fumes. They would cause me to have seizures. Mm-hmm. So there was a special structure outside the bubble where they would do the cooking. So it was really, ironically, it's interesting. When you take away all the modern conveniences and it's just you and your kids, it's a magical time for the kid because it's one-on-one. It's, attention, one-on-one attention day in and day out. And believe it or not, it really has, a lot of benefits growing up as a little kid where you have all this interaction with your mom or your dad.
Now, the drug you took was called Neurontin, which is normally prescribed for seizures and such. What sort of dosage did you have and any side effects from the Neurontin? Not that that really mattered to you, I suppose.
That's a very interesting question, Joseph. The Neurontin, they ramped me up to an extremely high dose. If there's any physicians listening here, and I told you the dose, which was 4,800 milligrams a day, they would probably gasp. It was so high of a dose. But that was the dose that was needed. And yes, there was a lot of side effects, drowsiness, sleepiness, it affects your senses. It basically numbs you. And what it does is it puts a Band-Aid on the brain cells that were injured. And these brain cells needed time to relax and calm down, and that's exactly what the Neurontin did, but with all those side effects going along with it.
I want to ask about your relaunching your career as the toxic tort lawyer, but before I do, I just want to know how you are right now. Have you regained your health, or are there permanent effects, you say, of your nervous system, your immune system, and your brain?
That's an interesting question. What had happened to me was I was permanently injured. So I have permanent brain injury and permanent nervous system injury. And I manage it just like a diabetic manages diabetes, by watching what they eat, by taking their insulin, by doing proper diet and proper exercise. What I do is I continue to take the Neurontin. I watch what I eat. I watch what I breathe. I watch where I go. And I live a very stringent lifestyle, and within those confines, I can function.
Do you ever get relapses?
Yes, actually, I've had two relapses since then. And when I had my last relapse, they actually put me inside a hyperbaric oxygen chamber. And I had that therapy 125 times, which got me back. It stabilized me again.
That's a pressurization device, correct?
Right. Right. It was originally invented for divers,
right,
when they had the,
yeah,
bends. They would put them in there, they would pressure it, and they would put oxygen in there. And they've since learned that they could use it for a lot of chronic diseases. Wound healing is a primary disease that they use it for. But they also do it for brain injury as well. And that's what I used it for. So they infuse 100% oxygen under high pressure into this oxygen pod that you go in. And it infuses oxygen into every cell in your body.
Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in, 1-800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. Also, email radio@WLRN.org, radio@WLRN.org.
And
please keep them
brief. Okay. Thanks. So let's talk about when you finally got well and you could relaunch your career and you became a toxic tort lawyer now, no longer a prosecuting crime-busting attorney, but a toxic tort lawyer. Tell us about that.
Well, interesting. When I got back out of the bubble, I had felt that I stumbled upon the ultimate crime, which is what human beings are doing to ourselves. And instead of prosecuting one crime at a time, which I had in the past, I wanted to pursue tackling the ultimate crime, which is the chemicals that we're all being exposed to. So I ended up interfacing with some pretty big-name people. I don't know if you've heard of the movie Aaron Brockovich, starring Julia Roberts. But Aaron Brockovich had a boss. He was in the movie. I hooked up with her boss. His name is Ed Massery. He was the lawyer in the movie. Basically, there were thousands of people that were contacting Aaron Brockovich because of the movie, but they didn't have time to answer those letters. So all the Dear Aaron letters went to Alan, and Alan was reading the letters and trying to help as many victims as I could that reached out to them. I also hooked up with another famous lawyer. I don't know if you remember that movie back in 98. It's called A Civil Action, starring John Travolta. It was about a real-life lawyer that represented sick people in Boston that were poisoned by toxic chemicals dumped into their river.
Oh, that's right.
And John Travolta played this character. It was a New York Times best-selling book, and I hooked up with him. His name was Jan Schlickman, and he actually wrote my book, the foreword in my book. And if anybody is interested in the book, you could go to alanbell.me, alanbell.me. You could download a free chapter as a result of this special show, and you could learn a lot about what I'm doing and the things that you could do to protect yourself and your family.
Okay, we're going to get to some of those. This is a good point, though, to just put a little period and take this last break, and we'll be right back. We're speaking with Alan Bell, who was a former organized crime prosecutor and has written Poisoned, How a Crime-Busting Prosecutor Turned His Medical Mystery into a Crusade for Environmental Victims. We'll be right back and take your calls.
And we're back. It is today's topical currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and attorney and author Alan Bell. We're talking about sick building syndrome, among other things. Alan Bell, if one is thinking about going into a condo or a new office building or something, it's a high-rise in particular, what should they look for? What are the indicators of sick building syndrome?
Well, the first thing you should do is make sure that people are not spraying pesticides indoors. That's one of the most toxic things to do. And there's safe alternatives. If you have cockroaches or ants, just simply putting boric acid on the floor will do the trick. If you've got mice or rats, put mice traps, they work great. And if you've got termites, don't tent it with toxic chemicals. They have new services that actually microwave the building. They put microwaves in there, you leave the building, they microwave it, they kill all the bugs, and you go back in, and it's perfectly non-toxic. So that's one thing I would do. The other thing is, paint on the wall is a big issue. You do not want to have paints that emit volatile organic compounds, which are chemicals that float into the air that you breathe that cause illness. There are safe paints out there that you could buy that are called zero VOC paints, and they're non-toxic. My book shows all this. The floors, you don't want carpeting. You want tile, or you want real wood, not particle board wood on the floor, because that's loaded with formaldehyde as well. And if you really do want carpeting, you can get safe carpeting. It's out there. My resource guide in my book covers all that. But more importantly than all those other things in your house is the bed that you sleep in. You spend a third of your time sleeping. So the last thing in the world you want to do is sleep in a bed that's toxic. So what you do is you buy an organic cotton bed that does not have flame retardants in it, and now you're taking a third of your life and you're making it all that much less toxic. That's a great thing to do.
So where do you find where do you find these kind of beds?
Well, it's all the resources are actually in my book.
Okay.
But if you can't buy my book, all you got to do is Google organic cotton beds, no flame retardants, and there's a whole market for that, and it's a growing market. It's a growing market. Okay. Also, the air conditioning is very, very important. You want to make sure that there's no mold growing in the ducts. If you have metal ducts, it's better than plastic ducts. And you want to have somebody go in and examine the ductwork to make sure that there's not mold growing in the ductwork or in the air conditioning vents. It's a pervasive problem in South Florida. I can't tell you how many thousands of emails and phone calls I've received from people in South Florida that have been poisoned by mold.
And we have an emailer, Todd, which ties in with something I want to ask you. He says this is his key political issue and the thing that upsets him the most, the ability of the chemical companies to put toxic chemicals in the environment regardless of the harm. He said to ask you what you think of the chemical law that just passed Congress. And that ties in with a question I want to ask you. We have less regulations and less attention paid to what's going on in the air and on the earth right now. So what can people do? What advocacy measures can they take?
Slackened EPA regulations.
Exactly.
Okay, I'm going to hit this issue more head on. What I advocate is not closing smokestacks or standing on picket lines or lobbying in Congress or saving the whales or the birds or the trees or the ice caps. My message is very simple. What you can do to protect yourself and your family from becoming another statistic. Now, this gentleman brings up a very good point. The government is not protecting us. Why? The reason why is that there's a symbiotic, cozy relationship between corporate America and Congress. There's powerful chemical lobbyists that lobby Congress into keeping the laws just the way they are. And the way the laws are in the United States is simply this. That all chemicals are presumed innocent until proven guilty. That means any chemical or any product containing any chemical could be brought into your environment, whether it's in the form of a baby carriage or a bed or baby bottles, and it's presumed innocent or safe until proven guilty. That means we get all these toxic products that are being dumped into America from China with the Chinese toxic particle board and everything else, and we're being exposed to all this. So what needs to happen is that we need to change the laws where chemicals are presumed guilty until otherwise proven innocent. That will protect us. There are laws like that on the books in Canada. Other countries like Germany and England and France have those laws, but not in the United States. So the result is that we cannot rely upon our government to protect us. We cannot rely upon our doctors to fix us. So this means we need to take matters in our own hands and arm yourself with knowledge so you can modify your lifestyle and minimize your risk and prevent yourself and your family from becoming ill. And that's what this book targets. It basically lays this case out to you. It shows you why we can't rely on anybody and what you can do to protect yourself and your family.
And the book we're talking about is Poisoned, How a Crime-Busting Prosecutor Turned His Medical Mystery into a Crusade for Environmental Victims. So I don't know if you want to...
Let's take a quick phone call. Tyne in Deerfield Beach. I'm short on time, Tyne. Hi.
Hey, how you doing? Alan.
Yes.
Are you at dinner?
No, I had dinner last night. But I was eating dinner last night with Harry Seamus, and we had a long talk about you, Tiny. How are you doing, buddy?
Oh.
I've been better. But listen, a question about toxicity and the environment real quick. Now, you know that I know a lot about this subject because my lifestyle has changed because of my not knowing you, where I've become a vegetarian. I grow organic gardens. I grow my own food. And I've taken an active stance in saving the environment, thanks to you. But I want to mention to you that people need to know that their olfactory senses work, and that when they smell something and it doesn't smell correct in the building or in their office or in an apartment, there's something wrong. Always. Mm. Always something wrong if you smell it.
Mm-hmm. That's a very good point. And had I listened to my olfactory senses when I went into that building, you walk into a building, it smelled new and fresh. And it's just like when you buy a new car, that new car smells so good, but it's so toxic for you. And if you listen to your body and you walk into a place and you don't feel right, there's something wrong. Your body is telling you something. Look, we use pesticides. We spray it on our crops to keep the bugs away. The bugs are smarter than humans. They know not to eat the vegetation that's sprayed with the pesticides because they know it will kill them. So they stay away from it. But what we do is we take these foods and we eat them. So we need to listen to our bodies like even the most primitive organisms such as bugs do.
You know, Alan, we don't have that much time, unfortunately. Your book has so many how to test for things, you know, for asbestos and mold and radon and all those things. And you have loads of tips on how we can modify our lifestyles. But I just have a couple of things I would like you to address. One is how someone gets diagnosed with all the trouble you had. That's one. That might be feeling some of these things. And the other question is for those who don't have the means that you did to go live in a bubble, or that don't have the means to shop at Whole Foods, or that don't have the means to get, you know, certain of these organic cotton beds. Do you know? What do they do?
Okay. In answer to your first question, if your viewers could jot this down, get your pen, there's an academy called the American Academy of Environmental Medicine. All you got to do is Google it. It's a group of doctors that just specialize in this. And they have doctors all over the country. I would suggest going to one of them. In answer to your second question, if you don't have the economic means to really, you know, make a huge difference, there's simple things that you can do, and I'll give you an example. Let's say you have lead or asbestos or mold or other chemicals in your house that are making you sick. Well, the first thing I would do is suggest is move out. But if you can't move out, open up your windows and ventilate your house. That's very, you know, a very important thing to do. Let's say you're living in an old building that's 40 years old and it's got lead in the pipes. And every time you turn on the water, you're getting lead that's going onto your skin, and you're drinking it, and you're bathing it, and you're cooking it. A simple remedy to that is turn on the shower or turn on the faucet, let the water run for 2 minutes, and all the water that's contained in that water, all the lead that is contained in that water is going to go down the drain instead of inside your body or on your body. And there's many, many other tips that are simple, cheap, that are in my book that many people can use to make a huge impact on their own lives. And let me just close with this if I can. You know, nobody is immune from this environmentally linked disease. It comes in cancers, autoimmune diseases, heart disease, lupus, scleroderma. They're all environmentally linked. It doesn't matter how rich you are or how poor you are, whether you're black, white, yellow, red, whether you're Christian or Muslim or Jewish, we're all in the same boat and we're all at risk. And that's the thing here. It doesn't matter if you have more money than the next person. You're still equally at risk.
Well, we want to thank you. We're going to have links to your website, which is allenbell.me, and the American Academy of Environmental Medicine. We'll have that listed on our website, along with a link to your book, which is Poisoned, How a Crime-Busting Prosecutor Turned His Medical Mystery into a Crusade for Environmental Victims. Allen Bell, former organized crime prosecutor, toxic tort lawyer, and now a victim, survivor, advocate, avenger, and author. We thank you very much for being with us today, and we wish you the best.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bonnie. Thank you, Joseph. I'm happy to be there.
And apologies to those callers we couldn't get to, Scott and Stephen and a couple of others. Thanks for tuning in this hour. Our lead producer is Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Polly Landis. Thanks to Kevin Stockdale of KCUI Public Radio in Stockdale, California. Bonnie and I return tomorrow with another edition of Topical Currents, which begins with a study of Florida Keys history and the relatively new Florida Keys History and Discovery Center in Isla Mirada. Also, Linda Gastenheimer discusses a new Miami trend in the food cart craze, job training. Job training and food carts. Of course, it's easy to download free audio archives of each program at our website, WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page, as well as our iTunes podcast. Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next from NPR News.